This is Boris Elise interviewing for the Creative Push Project on December 17th, 2016 at 12:35 p.m. Okay, can you say your name and your age?
Nicole Gonzalez, and I'm 36.
Excellent. Okay. So why don't we start with you just giving me a little, like, family background, you know, where you're from, you know, any family
history? So I'm Danae, and I grew up in Waterflow, New Mexico with my mom and my stepdad, and we have your typical blended family. I actually have 8 siblings, and it was a really nice childhood. We traveled to North Dakota, South Dakota, selling jewelry, visiting people, and going to powwows. And my dad actually lived, I would say, 10 minutes south on the Navajo Reservation. He's a diesel mechanic, and he lived in a trailer. I have a lot of fond memories of visiting him because I would play in the ditch and go jump in the river in the summertime and go climb what it's called Little Hogback, and just have my little tea parties up there by myself. And I often think about my kids not having that kind of childhood today because we're too afraid to send them out to do stuff like that by themselves. But those were really good times. My mom, she worked for a coal mine. She used to drive the big coal trucks. My whole family actually worked for for one of the coal mining companies up there. There's 3 of them. But my grandfather, my uncles, my aunts, my mom, my dad, everybody worked for coal mines. And I feel like they provided us a really good income, and I think that's why a lot of my relatives work there. My mom did a lot of shift work. She'd work night shift, and weekends, holidays, until she injured her back, and then she stopped working. And my stepdad continued to work there until he retired recently from an injury. And she, after she married my dad, my stepdad, they had 2 more children who are my little brother and sister. And so I pretty much raised them. They were with me everywhere I went in high school. People thought they were my kids because they were always with me. And my family really liked to travel a lot, and so I really am thankful for their adventurous side because I also like to travel still. My mom and dad today make teepees, and that's their business. I feel like my mom was just always kind of a natural entrepreneur. She sold Mary Kay. She made jewelry. She sews nonstop these days, and they make teepees. Still sell jewelry here and there. So they're pretty... they're pretty busy even though they're retired. My stepdad, he grew up in the Native American church, and so he introduced that to our family when I was pretty young. Having people over for all night meetings and having a teepee in the backyard, that was normal for me. My parents would often go on the weekends to other families' homes to do ceremonies for them for healing. And that was just a normal kind of thing that we did. You know, my mom, she would pray over us. She would get her cedar out and her fan, and she would pray over us if we had a big test or if we're having family issues, she would pray. A lot of my milestones growing up was like that. My 16th birthday, we had an NAC meeting. For graduation, I had an NAC meeting, and if there were problems, we had Sweat Lodge, and we'd sit and talk with our family and have a Sweat Lodge. To me, that was really normal. I don't think I realized how lucky I was to have that growing up. My dad, who is a diesel mechanic, he has a new family as well. He's got another son with my stepmom and has a very big family as well. He's got 8 siblings. And we would go to their sheep camp and play outside. And for Thanksgiving or Christmas, we'd go over and visit. He's a farmer, so he was always outside irrigating the field or planting corn. He really liked to be outside and work. So I feel like I got a good balance of kind of being outdoors and being indoors.
Do you remember your mother being pregnant?
I do remember my mom being pregnant with her first child, which was my sister. I think I was maybe 9 or 10. I remember having her, she's had this big belly, maybe she was 8 or 9 months. And we would go for walks. So in Waterflow, we lived off right off the highway of 550. So we would walk up and down the road for like exercise, and she'd be walking with her pregnant belly. People would stop and ask if we needed a ride because maybe we thought we had car broken down. And my mom would tell them, no, I don't need a ride. We're just getting exercise. But she went to the hospital in Farmington and had her baby. And during that time, you know, kids were not allowed in the hospital. And I remember really missing her when she was gone at the hospital. It felt like forever. I don't really know how long she was gone. And because I was the only child at home with my stepdad, it felt very quiet and lonely when she wasn't there. But she went to the hospital, and, you know, next thing you know, she came home with a baby, and it was my sister. And, you know, I don't really remember my sister so much as a baby. I was very much the big sister, helping change diapers and, you know, taking care of them when she was away for POD meetings or, you know, helping my dad. And then I guess she must have had a miscarriage at some point between my sister and my brother, and they had some sort of ceremony done. And then she had my brother, who I was really happy to have more kids in the house. It was less quiet. And he was pretty healthy baby. You know, again, I was curious. I wanted to be there with her at her birth, but I couldn't. I think my mom likes to laugh because the first thing I said to her was like, they look like one of them, which my dad had three children from another marriage. And so I was making a reference that they look like his side of the family. They kind of laughed about that. But, you know, I'm really close to my little brother and sister because I spent so much time taking care of them. I know when I went to college, they were pretty sad and upset to see me go.
Did you understand the birth process? Did she share any of that with you at a young age?
I didn't understand the birth process. No, she didn't tell me about babies or how they came to be. It wasn't until I became older and had my own children that I began to ask my mom about how my birth was. And she said she doesn't quite remember. She says, I want to say like 5 or 6 months, she and my dad got divorced. And I think that was really traumatic for her. And so she didn't remember my pregnancy or my birth. It kind of bothers me that she doesn't remember that sort of thing with me. But, you know, when I start asking her about my sister's birth and my brother's birth, like, she doesn't quite remember either. Unless, you know, she's sitting across from my aunt who was with her for each of those births, then it's like her mind is jarred that my sister needed a vacuum-assisted delivery before she could come out. She doesn't know if she had an epidural or not. She doesn't quite remember those things.
So can you tell us about your first pregnancy, like all the way back to the conception? You know, what were the circumstances? Was it expected? Was it a surprise?
It was definitely a surprise. My husband and I had been dating for 2 years, and he asked me to marry him in January, and it was really lovely and engagement. And then a couple months later, I found out I was pregnant, and I had a miscarriage that first time. And then not too much longer, I found I was pregnant again. And I was really happy and excited, even though it wasn't planned or expected. I definitely was concerned that people would think that I got pregnant and then we got married. But that's not what happened. And I know he was really happy and excited. At the time, I was working as a nursing assistant at a rehab hospital in Albuquerque. I was really interested in becoming a nurse when I met my husband. I was actually going to school to be a doctor when we met. And so when we got engaged, you know, the plan changed a little bit, and I thought, well, I kind of want a family. I don't really want that busy life that the doctor has, so maybe I'll be a nurse. And so I did everything I could to learn about nursing, to get education training in nursing before I applied to nursing school. But I was probably in my second year of college when I got pregnant with my daughter. And I was really sick. I was so sick. I had to stop my working, and I threw up so many times a day, and I had to keep trash bags in my car because the motion made me sick. It was really difficult. And I really had a hard time finding a doctor I liked. I had no knowledge about midwifery or what kind of options I had available to me. I asked my sister-in-law who she saw for her pregnancies, and she referred me to her doctor, and he was okay. I don't think I had any preconceived ideas about what kind of care I would get. I just knew he was a doctor, and he listened to my belly when I went in to see him, and that was it. Like, there wasn't really a relationship there. I didn't expect one. About our third or fourth month that I was pregnant, we got married. And in the Pueblo culture, it's like a big old weekend event with lots of hard work and baking bread and, you know, working with the community. And me being a young 20-year-old, I had no idea that's what all entailed. I thought the white wedding and the dress and off with my girlfriends and having a, like, bachelorette party, like, I didn't have any of that. I was sick and I was pregnant and I was trying to do my best to please everybody to have this wedding. And so the day of my wedding, I was still sick. My father-in-law had gotten me a breakfast burrito with chili, and oh, I just couldn't keep it down. And it's funny because that first, after we got married in the church in San Ildefonso Pueblo, they take you to your home or your family's home, and they talk to you about being married and how to treat each other, and you choose speakers to talk to you about marriage. This can go on all day and all night. It just kind of depends. So while your cooks are feeding everybody at a different location, the community is talking to you about getting married or being married. Once the conversation ends and they can release you, then you can go eat. So is probably maybe 4 or 5, maybe in the day that I got to eat for the first time. And I was really sick. And we went to our reception, and we're sitting at the table, and I'm trying not to throw up. And I'm telling my husband, you know, can you please go grab me some bread and some water? I said, I don't feel very good. And he's looking at me like, okay, but he's not going anywhere. And I'm getting really mad. Because I'm like, okay, is this what it's going to be like? You know, your wife is sick. You're embarrassed to go grab some food because you don't want to offend anybody. And I'm going to throw up on my dress. So I was really upset. And finally somebody came and brought us some food. And he saw that I was really upset with him. Like, I was trying not to cry sitting there. And it's hard not to do that when people are looking at you. And I was in my mind thinking, God, is this what I married? Is this guy not going to take care of me? My needs going to come last when I'm pregnant and sick, and he's not going to grab me food. Like, you have that realization. But he did something kind of very sweet. But he knew I couldn't say no. We had a guy who came and played music while people were eating, and he played a song for me, and he said, can my wife come and dance with me? And I couldn't say no. And so he asked me to go dance, and I forgave him by that point. And so we got through that first part. It was probably, out of all three of my pregnancies, the hardest part of it was being sick and throwing up. And the remaining of my pregnancy, I don't think I was really aware of what kind of mom I wanted to be. I hadn't read any literature. I know a lot of moms today are very self-aware about what kind of mothers they want to be, and I just wasn't. I was 20, and, you know, I didn't have a plan. I also had just been married into this family who I really adored and loved, my husband's family, and I feel like I was just really trying to please everybody. And I hadn't made any plans about the birth, or, you know, I was reading What to Expect When You're Expecting, and kind of excited to see the changes to my body every week. I think through that whole pregnancy, we only got one picture of my belly. And it was pretty uneventful. I guess, I don't know if I gained a lot of weight or not. I don't quite remember. I was also still in school full time being pregnant. And so I was pretty focused on my education. My husband at the time, he was working in like the eastern part of New Mexico. So it's an hour and a half drive one direction, an hour and a half back. So when he would get home from work, he was pretty tired.
So did you fall into some traditional roles of husband and wife?
Yes and no. When I met my husband, my mom was very stern with him and had a talk that I was going to finish school before we did anything. We don't follow that, obviously, but I was determined to finish school for my own reasons. So we weren't traditional in that sense. I think as far as being a mom and staying home and taking care of myself during my pregnancy, I think I was immature in my 20s and just thinking that was my role.
Did you, so you had so many other things on your plate besides just focusing on your birth and the pregnancy. So, but did you have a moment to think about like, did you just think, well, I'm going to go to the hospital and whatever happens, happens? Or did you...
Right. So we did go to childbirth preparation classes. And that was really exciting to be in a room full of moms and dads. And we were really attentive listening. I think it was like a 4-week class. I remember doing the breathing. And then they're showing us the forceps and the vacuum. And my husband's looking at me. He's like, those things are not going to get used on our child. But I was just kind of naive, like, oh, okay, those are tools to help with delivery. And I believe we did that towards the end of our pregnancy. I remember the morning my labor contractions started. It was like 2 a.m. and I was like, oh, the contractions are starting. And I kind of, you know, woke him up and shoved his arm a little bit. It was like, hey, you know, contractions have started. He's like, really? Do we need to go to the hospital? And I'm like, no, they're coming, but I don't think it's going to be a while yet. But by that point, I couldn't go back to sleep. So I get up and we're cleaning our house because our baby room isn't quite ready and, you know, making sure my bag is ready to go and, you know, and the contractions are still like cramping every couple of minutes and, you know, just some of those changes I noticed in my body. And I had actually a doctor's appointment that day and my husband was going to work and he was like, do I need to go to work or do I stay? And I said, no, go to work. I have a doctor's appointment. I said, this is probably just early labor. And then I'll call you if I need you. So he goes to work. And then I go to the doctor's office. And the doctor looks at me and he says, well, we're going to induce you today. And I was like, oh. I said, well, I thought I was still pretty early in labor. He says, no, your blood pressure is really high and we need you to go to labor and delivery right now. And I'm like, okay, but I feel fine. It's not till years later that I was like thinking about my last trimester of my pregnancy and looking at pictures. Like I was really swollen. My feet were really swollen. My face was swollen. I remember getting headaches. I remember flashes of light when I moved in my vision. Which to my knowledge today is telltale signs of preeclampsia. But I didn't know that then. I felt fine as far as I know. So I remember going to labor and delivery. I just walked over because he was in the same building. And they put an IV in, and I called my husband. I was like, okay, it's, you know, they're going to induce me today. You need to come over and see me and get my stuff. And so he was excited. And I believe they used Pitocin to get my labor going a little more. And my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law were there. And I called my mom, and she came. And I was kind of unsettled about who I wanted to be at my birth. Again, I was in my young 20s, trying to please everybody, not wanting people to feel left out. But really, you know, if it was years later, it would have just been me and my husband. I wouldn't have had so many people there. My relationship with my sister-in-law when we were married early on was really difficult. She really was judgmental about me and my role. why he married me at all. A lot of our disagreements during our pregnancy was because of her. So to have her at the birth was kind of my peace offering, because his mom was insistent that she should be there and wanted to be there to support. So I allowed it. But while she was there, like, she was on her phone the whole time, and, you know, there's pictures of her talking on the phone over my bed, and a little distracting. But I did get an epidural for pain because the Pitocin got pretty intense and strong. And I didn't feel anything once the Pitocin was in, or not, sorry, the epidural was placed. I was pretty comfortable. I still to this day don't know what my blood pressure looked like. I do remember when it came time to push, you know, the doctor's sitting there at the edge of the bed and my legs are spread open. And I can't even remember if I was in stirrups or not. I might have been. But I'm pushing, but I'm not feeling anything. And I'm looking down at him, asking him, am I pushing appropriately? And he's not giving me any feedback. So I'm looking to my right, talking to the nurse, like, is this how I push? And she says, oh, yeah, you're doing fine. You need to push this way. And I probably was pushing for almost 3 hours when they finally decided to use some forceps. So they used the forceps to help her out. And she came out, and the first thing I saw was her big belly. Like, big belly, crying baby. They bring her over to me, and I'm like, you know, like, great, you know, she's out. And they take her right away over to the warming station. And you just see her belly. It's all I can see. She's just big baby on her belly, and she's got rolls at her arms. And anyway, my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law over there were checking on her, and my mom's looking at her, and my husband didn't leave my side. He looked at her, but he was more concerned about me. And I think I asked him if everything looked okay, and he says, well, it looks pretty bad down there. I was like, okay. And then I start to feel very lightheaded, like I want to black out, like I'm getting really warm and fuzzy, and I want to close my eyes and go to sleep. And then there's another nurse coming in, and the voices are fading, and the doctor says, give it to her in her leg, and they give a shot to me in my right leg, and I didn't really feel it because I had the epidural. But my husband's like, you know, don't go to sleep, talk to me. And they inverted the bed, so my head was lower. But everybody was getting pretty scared because apparently I was having a really bad postpartum hemorrhage that he was trying to stop. And he just said the blood was flowing out of me like a river. You could hear it. And I was just like, oh, okay. And then he stitched me up, and I didn't feel that either. And then right away after I was all done and stitched up, I was fine. But my husband was like, are you okay? You know, you look really pale. You know, are you all right? He was really concerned, and my mom was concerned. It wasn't too much longer after, maybe an hour or two, they came back in and they hung this stuff called magnesium sulfate, which I didn't really know what it was for. I think it was for, I mean, I know it's for now, but at the time it was, I think it was for my blood pressure because it was so high. And they had to keep that infusing on through me for 24 hours. And it made me really groggy and sleepy and foggy. And I didn't really feel like I got to connect with my daughter because I was kind of out of it. And people came and visited me, and I was still kind of trying to visit with them. And finally my husband's like, you don't have to talk. You can just rest. You don't have to talk to anybody. But that was for the preeclampsia that I had. And, you know, finally, I think I stayed at the hospital like 3 or 4 days, which is a long time. My daughter weighed 8 pounds, 15 ounces. She's a big girl. And when it came time to go home, you know, he carried her in the car seat, and the nurse was walking in front of him as a male nurse. And I was really surprised that, considering what I went through and how weak I felt, because when they had me get in the shower, I almost passed out, that they wanted me to walk to the car. And I was kind of like, slow down. I'm holding onto the wall to get through the hallway. And these two men in front of me walking really fast to get to the car. And I had to tell them to slow down because I'm having a hard time. But it from what I remember talking to the doctor after, I had a postpartum hemorrhage, I had preeclampsia, I had a forceps delivery, my daughter who was really big. I did not have diabetes because she's a big baby. I had a really bad third degree tear. So my bottom was pretty sore for a couple of weeks after, like achy when I moved. And it was, you know, I was exhausted and trying to breastfeed her after. I want to say I feel like I had a little postpartum depression after I had her, because I think it was during that time when they were really talking about, you know, that postpartum psychosis and women wanting to hurt themselves and their babies. And I was thinking in my mind, is that what I'm going through? Is that what I'm feeling? Do I want to hurt her? No, I don't want to hurt her. Like these kind of mental thoughts going through my mind. And I feel like I was really going through the motions for a long time with her, because I didn't know how to be a mom. You know I need to change her diaper and feed her and breastfeed her and put her to bed. But like that really connecting mothering that you hear women talk about, like I don't feel like I had that. I don't think it took me a while before I even got the hang of that.
I felt like that too. I felt like it was my new job.
Right. Right. And that's another thing, is it did feel like it was my new job. And my husband's family is very traditional in the sense that the male female roles are very specific. So I felt guilty if I wasn't putting her to bed or holding her or, you know, giving her the right kind of bath. And I have to say, I had family around who made me feel not very good to be a new mom, judging me. And even after I gave her a bath the first time, my sister-in-law gave her a bath again and clean her ears. And I'm like, is she not clean enough? Am I not doing a good enough job? Like, it just felt very much like that. And I feel like today that really helps me work with women better, because, you know, I remember all of those feelings with my first child. And just learning to be a mom, knowing that there's judgment everywhere. So I'm pretty thoughtful and encouraging to new moms, because I know what that felt like.
Yeah, I often say you're being judged the moment you conceive.
Right.
What you eat, what you don't eat, what you do or walk or not walk or whatever it is. There's no right way. You're always doing it wrong. Just a little bit, according to one person at least, you know. So you just have to do what is right for you.
Yeah. So, I do want to say, though, with her pregnancy, because I grew up with these traditions, I did do like a blessing way ceremony with her. And I've had it with each of my kids before I went into labor, or a month or so before, just because that's one of our Dene traditions. So even though, like, intellectually those ceremonies don't quite, how do I say, they've always been a part of my life. But the meaning and intention of them, on some level, I didn't quite get until later. I mean, I definitely understand it more now and can reflect and be like, man, I'm really glad I had those things done for me and I asked for them, even though I wasn't quite clear about why.
Did you have a name picked out, or how did you come up with a name? Did you know the sex?
So we knew the sex of her. We knew she was a girl. My mother-in-law's twin sister is named Charlotte. And her twin sister died when she was 5, I believe, from an illness. And so when she said her name was Charlotte, I was like, oh, we love that name. Nobody's named Charlotte. So we saved letting people know what her name was until after she was born. So it was a nice blessing for her mom to hear that we named her after her sister.
Was there anything special, you know, blankets or cribs or anything that people made for you, or that, you know, you still have, or, you know I still have an August baby blanket. And, yeah.
So in the Pueblo culture, they have a naming ceremony, which is, you're supposed to have it within a month, I think, after the baby's born. I think with her, we had it 3 months after. We chose one of the elders in the Pueblo to name her, and they named her Nana Katse, which I believe is yellow autumn leaf. And at the same time, I also got my Indian name when she got her Indian name. And so it was really nice to have a naming ceremony. So this person who does the naming ceremony is supposed to kind of guide them in the traditional way of living and teach them things, you know. They have dances in the Pueblo that the girls, the women have to dress up for and participate in. So to talk about those things and to share that knowledge. I mean, we're not born knowing how to lace up or put on our moccasins or put on our wraps or know what side our dresses need to be on or how to put on our sash belts. Like, those things are taught. So those are like things that the woman who names you would basically teach you those things. So they get their name at the first light. So when the sun comes up, then the light touches her, and then you can name them. Or you go to the Pueblo Kiva, and they give them a name then, during like different dances and stuff. So, but she got her name that way.
At the Kiva?
No, she did it in the Pueblo, but not during a ceremony or dance. It was a separate occasion. And they give her a blanket, and they dress her up in her moccasins, and her clothing, which I still have. And so they just have this connection with this person throughout their life.
That's a really, a lovely concept. And one of the things, you know, talking to other women is this kind of strength of community and family, and that, they're just really interconnected in a very strong way.
I think when it comes to that connection to family, that was something that was really attractive to me and different coming from my Diné culture, from the Pueblo culture. Before I met my husband, or actually while we were dating, there were times I came to the Pueblo for dances and stuff, and I helped bake bread and some of these like female engagement activities was really around cooking and baking bread and helping community through their act and their skills. And that's something that, because of culturally and spatially, the Diné culture is very different. Like, you know, my aunties and uncles live kind of a distance away. Some are Catholic, some are Christian, some are NAC, some are, you know, traditional Navajo, or they're all three or four. And so here, you know, you live close by, you see these women often, whether it's a funeral or a ceremony or something's happening in the community where you will see them or work with them. So usually, like, stories about how we take care of ourselves or just being with women is usually around the oven or cooking or something like that. But that was very attractive to me because I didn't grow up that way. Because my parents are divorced, my mom has a small family. I wasn't around a lot of women all the time. I was usually by myself or with my brother and sister. And there's challenges of having a blended family anyway. You know, my step-siblings were in and out of our lives because they were either mad or, you know, something. Like, we just weren't always all together all the time. But here, like, you know, there's specific times of the year where we're always together, like feast day or corn dance, or, you know, there's a different specific activity that, you know, you're going to be together to cook.
So was your Navajo language different than your husband's language?
It's very different. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the dialect is different. The how you pronounce things are different. The culture of women is different. So in the Diné culture, when we introduce ourselves, we're saying, I was born for. So you're going through your matrilineal heritage, explaining your clan system to introduce who you are, who you're born for, who your grandmother is, and where they live. So you have this kind of matriarchal history that you give when you introduce yourself. In the Pueblo culture, it's mostly patriarchal men. So I would say the feminists would probably not like it so much because women's roles are very colonistic in the sense that you're in the kitchen, you're helpers. But I would disagree with that. I feel like the Pueblo women are really strong in their beliefs, and they work really hard. But when something happens in the community, you see everyone come together and they assume different roles and they work really well together. It's more of a balance than one person doing everything or one group of people doing everything. It's always nice for me to see that. Whereas in the Diné culture, there's a lot of differences with death and birth, whereas a Pueblo, it's different, right? Because death for them is something they celebrate, and they have their way of taking care of their community members who've passed on. Whereas Diné, like, we don't want anything to do with death. Like, we can't be in a room with someone who passed away. We have to leave. Somebody else needs to take care of it. It's like a taboo. It can make you sick.
So how would you introduce yourself in the Pueblo culture?
I would just be, I don't speak Tewa. I speak a little bit, but, you know, there isn't an introduction. Versus, like, you know, if I were to go back home to, or if I were to meet another Diné person out in the world, they'd want to know what my clan was. Whereas in the Pueblo culture, I've never met anybody who wants to be introduced by their clan. I'm somewhat respectful of kind of how they do things, and they're kind of private about things. So I know some Tewa, and some is used for inside the house and some is used for outside. But there isn't like a specific way to introduce yourself.
So did your inclinations towards, you know, participating in helping women through birth and midwifery, like, begin after that first birth, or did it emerge later on?
It emerged over time. So obviously I've always been interested in birth. Really it was spurred by when I finished my nursing degree, I was pregnant with my second child, and I started working as a nurse on labor and delivery, and I was probably 6 or 7 months pregnant, and I was busy on my feet all day long, and he was probably my biggest baby. but I mean, the nurses were in awe of me because it's like, Nicole, you were pregnant and you kept up with all of us and you weren't complaining or tired. Like, I was just busy working. But that's how much I loved what I was doing, is I really loved working with women and making them feel good and comfortable and listened to, even as a nurse. What actually pushed me to become a midwife was I worked at IHS Hospital in I worked at an IHS hospital, basically, on medical surgical, and I really didn't want to work there. I was really happy working at my labor and delivery work job, but because IHS had paid for my education, I had to fulfill my obligation for them paying for my education by providing them 2 years of my nursing experience as a job. And I have to tell you, going from this really nice labor and delivery unit where people work together and you were expected to be nice to women, and it just was a very cohesive, warm group. I went to this other space that was dark and people weren't nice to each other and they complained. And, you know, I felt like some of the women didn't take pride in their work. I felt like they were just there to retire. And maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I just didn't see that pride that I saw in the other nurses I worked with there, with some of the nurses who worked there. And it was really a disappointment for me to see them behave, the nurses behave this way, and then to work with a community, my community of people, that wasn't the best care I feel like they could have gotten. An example would be, because they knew I had labor and delivery experience, and it's really only been a year I had been a labor and delivery nurse, they had me do some shifts over at labor and delivery in the IHS hospital. And at the time, there was a lot of turmoil happening because the IHS hospital was going to close their labor and delivery because they didn't have the high number of women birthing there, and their OB doctor was going to retire and they weren't going to replace him. There was a couple of nurse midwives who worked there, and they were white women that were caring for women, or at least Native women coming for care. There was one Navajo nurse I worked with, and she was very nice. And my first encounter with a midwife there was I was admitting a patient who was in labor to one of the really small rooms, and they were monitoring her on the fetal monitor, and I was going to check her blood pressure. So I put the blood pressure cuff on her arm, and this nurse midwife, who's an Anglo woman, was like staring me down the whole time, like so intimidating, staring me down as I'm putting this blood pressure cuff on this patient. And I'm like, why are you intimidating me? Like, this is not appropriate. And as I was getting to leave, you know, she goes over there and takes the blood pressure cuff off before I could. Like, just very, like, aggressive intimidation. And at that point, I was like, I really don't want to work over here if this is how these ladies are. And I talked to this Navajo nurse who was there, and I said, well, why do you work here? This place is so disappointing and dreary, and people are not nice to each other, so the morale is not good. And she said, you know, I feel like there's definitely some racism that goes on here between non-Native nurses and providers and patients, but I feel like these women need to see a Native woman, a Native nurse taking care of them, and so I stay. So I was like, oh, okay. There was another shift I worked there with a woman from my community who was having a baby, her second baby, and having a C-section. And the story with her is she had lost a baby at this hospital in labor. And I'm not sure of all the details, but the baby had died. And so she was coming back to have another baby, and I was asking her, why are you here to have this baby? Like, why can't you go someplace else? And she says, well, I don't feel like I could go anywhere else. And I was just like, how awful to go to a place where your baby died, to not feel like you have options. And maybe it was at the fault of the provider. I don't know. Like, this to me feels wrong. There was a labor and delivery nurse who sounds like she was a nurse practitioner who had just the nastiest attitude. She would put like 18-gauge IVs in everybody, which is one of the biggest IVs to put in women. I mean, you really don't need a big one to transfuse blood, but she would go above and beyond for that. And she said, I'm afraid they're going to have a postpartum hemorrhage. I'm just being safe. But I'm like, that's not right. But at one point during working there, she definitely gave me a piece of her mind, and I was crying, and I was like, I'm done working here. I don't need to deal with people like you. Like, it was just one incident after another where people were just very rude, intimidating. Even my nursing supervisor was intimidating. And so I was more than happy to give up my 2 years and then get out of there. But it was during that time I approached one of the Anglo midwives there about midwifery, because I was applying. I had my application. And so I just asked her casually, well, do you consider, is midwifery a mid-level? Like, how would you define that? And I was just curious. She didn't know I was applying. I just had this question for her. And she, like, totally went off on me. We're not mid-level providers. We're healthcare providers. We're nurse midwives. We're not physician extenders. So it was just right away lashing out at me about just a question I was asking her. And I'm just like, geez, here's another opportunity where she could have maybe helped me with my application, but she totally, like, I'm like, I don't want to talk to you then. Seeing my community being cared for like that, feeling like they have options, like, that really did something inside of me, because I was like, I can't sit back and do nothing. We can't just allow this to happen. You know, this is not okay. And I had to really struggle with my husband and his family about going back to school, because, again, we had these very traditional roles. I had just finished nursing school. Why do I want to go back to school? My kids are little. Why do I need to go to school now? Can I do it later? What about the kids? So I had a lot of doubt pushed in my direction about my path. And I felt really guilty because I wanted to be a good mom. And was I being a bad mom if I decided to go back to school? So I held off not applying to nurse midwifery school. And the following year, there were some more things happening in our pueblo I saw. Just some really heartache, hardship, people not being taken care of again. And I was just like, I don't care what you guys say. I'm going to go to school. This is just, this feels right to me. It probably took a good 6 months before my family, my husband and his family finally kind of recognized what I was doing and why. And he definitely became more supportive of going back to school and what I was doing and how much I really loved it. And he saw me change completely to being kind of this lost mom trying to figure out what I'm doing and if I'm going to do, if I'm doing it to everyone's expectations, to being more in charge of who I am and what I'm doing. And I don't care what anybody says. This is what I am going to do because this makes me happy. And so he was very supportive after that.
So how was your, did you have preeclampsia with your second birth?
I didn't. My second birth, I had, so I was working as a nurse on labor and delivery. And I was in nursing school, about to finish my last semester in nursing school at UNM. And the nurses were more than happy that I was pregnant because they got to feel my belly and all of that. And we had this woman come into our nursing class and show us or teach us about hypnobirthing. And I was like, hey, this is really interesting, hypnobirthing. Prior to my pregnancy with him, I was not happy with the first doctor I had seen. So I went to see different doctors before I found the one I really liked. At that point, I'd had two miscarriages before I got pregnant with my son, Daniel. And after my second miscarriage, during my second miscarriage, I went to the ER because I was bleeding so much that my husband had to take me to the emergency room. And there was this man there who was the doctor on call, and he was so sweet. He was holding my hand. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to go take you back to do a DNC. And my husband was kind of waiting in a chair right before they took me back. And he said, hold on, stop, you know, had them stop the gurney before I went back to the OR and made sure my husband gave me a hug and a kiss and reassured us both that things were going to be fine. And after that, I was like, what's this doctor's name? This guy is exactly who I want to take care of me. And so I probably went through two OB doctors before I found him. And so he took care of me through my whole pregnancy. It was very lovely. He gave me a handshake and kissed me on the cheek. It was like visiting my grandpa every day, you know, very kind guy. So it was a very different pregnancy to begin with because there was communication, there was a relationship. I felt good about who I was seeing for my care. I was healthy. I don't feel like I gained too much weight. I wasn't horribly sick with him in the beginning. I was kind of toying with the idea of having a home birth because with one of my miscarriage, we did see a midwife in Albuquerque who actually I heard on the radio before I got pregnant. She was talking about midwifery on the news, on the radio news, and she was so intelligent. Like she was belting out research and evidence-based care about for what she did and how she did it. And she had doctors coming in challenging her, but she just knew her stuff. Like, she was very knowledgeable, and I was like, midwifery is pretty awesome. But I sought her out at a home birth practice in Albuquerque, but that pregnancy ended in a miscarriage. But after the first pregnancy, my family was like, you know, don't deliver at home. You're not healthy enough. You need to think about the safety of this baby and deliver in the hospital. So I was like, okay. But fast forwarding to my nursing education, I learned about this hypnobirthing, and I was like, yeah, I want to do that. And so I met with this woman later, and she was like, well, you're a little late in your pregnancy, but we could probably still do it. So we paid for it. It was kind of pricey. It was like $800. But I was like really committed. I'm like, I really don't want pain medicine. I really want to do this natural, and I think this hypnobirthing is going to work. And my husband's kind of like, okay. You know, kind of giving me the look like you're crazy, but it's your baby. Let's just do it. And so he did some exercises with me at home. We listened to music and she came and talked to us. And so I went through this kind of fast forward hypnobirthing process. I remember even giving a folder of information to my doctor because that was part of the process. He probably was rolling his eyes at me because most doctors don't like to do that sort of thing. But I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And my husband's family was kind of like, are you hypnobirthing? What is that about? And they were kind of heckling me too because they thought it was a little bit out there. But I didn't care. I was like, you know, it's going to work. And sure enough, it did. When I went into the hospital, I played my music. I had my headphones on. I think there's even a picture of me with on the birthing ball, kind of swaying back and forth. And the room is dim. Like, I had a little more control this time, and I liked it. My sister-in-law, my mother-in-law was there. My mom didn't come. But it was a very different space than it was the first time. And I realized I had a say about what I wanted and didn't want. And they still put an IV in me, but it was just very nice. I remember that, like, soft voice in my headphones was like, breathe, you know, very calm. Your baby is opening and coming down. Like, it was just very, like, calming. And everyone thought I looked very comfortable and collected. And at some point, I was like, okay, it's time to push. And they were like, what? So they put me in bed, and, you know, I think one or two pushes, and my son was out. And they were just amazed that I was so calm and collected. And, you know, the contractions, I definitely felt them, and they really hurt, but I felt like I could handle them. Like, they were manageable. I wasn't out of control. And after that, my sister-in-law even wanted to borrow my tapes, and, like, she saw me and wanted to do that for herself, and I'm just like, yeah, it is possible to have a nice, natural birth the way I want.
Were the contractions different when you went through it naturally to the Pitocin? Can you think about
that? Yeah, they were different. They had a pattern of their own. They were more manageable, gradual. Like, definitely during the end, like, I don't know. It kind of reminds me of the oven going bing. Like, that last contraction was really, really uncomfortable. Like, it hurt. I had tears in my eyes because it was so bad. But it was time to push. Like, I just remember, like, I got to push now. And that feeling of, like, needing to push, like, it's just indescribable. There's all this pressure in my bottom. Like, I just have to push. And so everyone was pretty happy to have my son out. And he was a big boy. He was 9-pound, 4-ounce baby. Big guy. And I'm just like, where did you fit?
Did you tear?
I had a little tear, like, but not like the first time. Yeah. So it was an all-around better experience, and I wasn't sad about it. I felt really good about it, and I was like, great, you know, everything went well. And I had him in the summer, like in May, so I had just finished my nursing program, graduated, and then I had him in the summertime. So that was nice.
Had you been using mineral oil or anything to kind of soften the perineum?
No, I wasn't. I didn't use anything. I wasn't that aware of my body. Yeah, nobody even talked to me about that at the time, I don't think. But it wasn't even the doctor who delivered. I mean, it wasn't the doctor I'd been seeing for my prenatal care who delivered him or assisted with the delivery. It was somebody else. But yeah, it was a really nice delivery.
And was it different in the fact that, like, after the baby was born, you were, you know, not fainting, you were not on
right
medication? Like, was your bonding experience different?
I think I feel like I recovered faster. My husband, after I had him, because there's a picture of me after I had him, my hair is to the side, my makeup's all smeared, and so some of the child preparation courses talk about when women go through transition, like that phase of 8 to 10 centimeters, like your sensory is heightened, smells, sounds, or you're really focused. And I remember while I was in labor, my husband, I think he ate something, and I was like trying to tell him to get some gum, and he says, oh, you want gum? I said, no, for you. Your breath smells. And he's like, okay. But he also, I told him, I said, I want barbecue for my dinner after I have the baby. So he had got me barbecue after I had my son, because I was starving. Because they starve you when you're having your baby. But I felt great. Like the next day, I was able to move around. I didn't feel tired. He latched onto the breast immediately after he was born and just kind of camped out there for a couple of days. I never had issues with breastfeeding in the sense that they didn't latch or I didn't want to breastfeed. Like, to me, breastfeeding was always normal because my mom breastfed my brother and sister, and, you know, she'd just lift up her shirt and put him on the boob, and that was normal to me. And so as my kids, I breastfed all of them. I didn't have enough milk for them. I don't know if it's because they were really big babies or because I was always busy working, but I just, you know, I always had to supplement with formula. But yeah, I felt great after I had them. So it was a really different experience from my first.
Yeah, well, that's so nice that you had that follow-up experience that was, you know, a healthier one for you, and that, you know,
right,
was more of what you intended. Yeah. So in your position as a midwife, what role do you see that you're playing in the birth experience? You know, obviously you're keeping the women healthy,
right,
you're monitoring things. Can you elaborate a little bit on that process?
I would say as a midwife, with working, how I work with women during their pregnancies is really just being really supportive. Like you said, like I've talked to other women about, there's so many negative, people watching you as you become a mother. And it's not always positive. You gain too much weight, you're eating the wrong foods. But women already know what they need to do to be healthy. It's just a matter of them making that decision for themselves. So I try and be more positive. You know, I have a lot of women who worry about how much weight they're gaining with their pregnancy, or, oh my gosh, I didn't take my prenatal vitamin yesterday because I felt bad. Like they're really afraid. And it's really difficult to navigate today as a new mom because there's so much information out there. Like if you were to Google something, everyone's got cancer and everybody's dying. Or, oh my gosh, this is a C-section situation. Like they're just really not fed good information sometimes. And so part of my work with them is to navigate that with them. Like, well, this is a reliable source. This is not a reliable source. I also remember how traumatic my first birth was, and I don't ever want anyone to come away from working with me feeling like their birth was a traumatic. I know that has a long-term effect on them. And so we do a lot of work at the very end talking about their birth. Who was there? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What's the worst case scenario? And just really reassuring that that's their space, they have control. If they don't want an IV, they can say no. Like they have the power to do these things. I don't think a lot of women know that they have that power when they go to the hospital, because it's just assumed that these are the policies, this is what we do, this is how we do every time. And I tell them, well, no, it's not really a policy. The nurses are used to doing it one way, but it doesn't mean you can't do it another way. And really, if we choose to deviate from what they're used to, you're actually teaching them another way. And they're going to get really comfortable with normal, natural birth because they don't see that very often. And they're like, oh, okay. But I also know women go into pregnancy and birth, well, specifically birth, with some assumptions that either I'm going to be there the whole time or it's going to be fast like on TV. So I try my best to talk through those things so that they don't have those assumptions and they're more prepared for what it could be like or what it is like. Because I'm also a sexual abuse survivor, I know those feelings of being not in control of my body. When those things happen to me as a child, like those things can also contribute to a woman's experience when they're pregnant. And so I'm really thoughtful about working with those women who have been sexually abused or raped at some point, because those feelings of being not in control come back when you're pregnant. And so, you know, again, we talk through what's the worst case scenario that could happen. And navigating all of the tests and the ultrasounds and the necessity for all of it or not. So it's, you know, it's really just, I feel like a guide and just someone who helps them feel good about themselves. I definitely feel it's challenging for me because of the word midwife has a lot of things attached to it, depending on who's pushing the midwifery movement forward. So even though historically midwifery's always been in our Native American communities, some of the understanding about that person and their role in our Native communities has kind of not been talked about like it used to be. And then you have this very Western influence of midwifery, which is the Ina May Gaskin. You know, a lot of women talk to me about spiritual midwifery that she wrote, and I'm like, I've never read her stuff. I didn't even know who she was when I became a midwife. And so there's assumption that because I'm a midwife and I'm working with women in the hospital, that I'm very, like, natural. Like, I have this natural knowledge of herbs and that, you know, I'm really against epidurals, or I'm against fetal testing or ultrasounds, blood test, which is not true. And then you have this other part of midwifery where it's very professional and licensed, polished. We are a profession of polished, educated women who work with women during not just their pregnancy, but through the many changes in their lifespan, and that we are skilled and educated to take care of these issues as they come up. So there's that part of it too. So it's really hard sometimes when I have a woman who wants this very natural, normal birth, and maybe she has some medical issues that wouldn't allow certain things, and I have to tell her, you know, because of this, you probably should get extra testing, or you probably should get genetic testing done because you are at risk because of these things. And some women get mad. They're like, you know, well, I thought, you know, they assumed I was a midwife and I was going to agree with them. But, you know, it's a fine balance. You don't come to me because I agree with you. You come to me because I'm knowledgeable in these things, and it's my job to be truthful with you and give unbiased information. And sometimes they want to hear it and sometimes they don't.
Do you think the practice of having a midwife involved in the birth process is becoming more common, or is it still a very small percentage of women that...
Are you thinking...
In the hospital that you work and the area that you're in?
So the hospital I work, there's always been midwives. Always. When I worked as a nurse, there was a midwife there. Before I was a nurse, there was a group of midwives. So there's just been a flux of midwives. For a short time, while I was finishing school, there was not a midwife there. And so when I went back to work in Los Alamos, there was a history of midwifery in the community. There's also a lot of women who birth at home with home birth midwives. And so I really support home birth. So it was really nice to have this kind of community of women already who support midwifery. Or they've been someplace where they've gotten care by a midwife, like the in another state or whatever. But New Mexico in general is a very midwifery-friendly state. There's not as many midwives out of Albuquerque as in some places. So, like, I'm the only nurse midwife in Los Alamos. And Presbyterian in Española Hospital, there's no midwives there. In Taos, there's some midwives who birth in the hospital and I believe birth with women in a birth center. Las Vegas, there are a group of midwives, but the hospital closed. I mean, their labor and delivery closed, and so those women have to go to Santa Fe to have their baby. Santa Fe has quite a few midwives who are home birth and hospital certified nurse midwives. But I feel like I do work in somewhat of a provider shortage area for women, because I get women from Cuba and from, you know, always sometimes up to the Colorado border to come see me for care, because there's no midwife that up that way, or even a hospital close enough to get to.
So you have three children.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about the third birth?
My third pregnancy, this is the one I was working as a nurse. He was really a surprise. I didn't think we had just moved into our house in San Ildefonso Pueblo, and I have to honestly say that the moment I was pregnant with each of them, I knew it. Like, my body temperature went up, I felt like I had the flu, like I just didn't feel good, and I was just thinking, I bet you I'm pregnant. And I took the pregnancy test, and it was positive, but it was really early. And so I didn't really want to be excited about it, because I had had 3 miscarriages already, and I wasn't ready to tell anybody. And I think this is a normal thing that women do when you had so many miscarriages. You're cautious, you're excited, you're somewhat optimistic, but you're like, well, I'm not going to get attached until it's past a certain point, and I know this is really going to stay. And so I was like that with him. And, you know, I was nauseous with him and exhausted and working as a nurse, but it wasn't like bedridden sick type thing. And I remember telling my husband, you know, we're pregnant, and he's like, great. And I said, well, let's see what happens. You know, I've had 3 miscarriages. I don't know what this one's going to be like. So we'll just see what happens. And I got past the 12 weeks and the 13 weeks and the 14 weeks. And I was like, okay, he's going to stay. But it was definitely a lot sooner than I would have liked, because my son Daniel had just been born like a year before, or almost a year before. So it was really closely spaced pregnancies. And I went through a pregnancy healthy, didn't have a lot of weight gain, but I also worked a lot in Los Alamos as a labor and delivery nurse. And I hardly ate, and I just was just really busy. And before I moved here, I had already connected with a doctor in Santa Fe and had planned to have my baby in Santa Fe. But he kept like having this false labor pattern at the very end. And because we would go walking in the Pueblo. All of us would go out with our strollers and we'd walk, my husband and I. But he would do this, like, I'd have this contractions and I'm like, okay, it's time. With my other 2 pregnancies, I never had this false labor. Like, once labor started, I had a baby. But not for David. Like, it was a day of contractions and then they would stop. And a day of contractions and they would stop. And it's like all these false alarms, because we had to figure out who was going to watch our other 2 if we went to the hospital. And my mother-in-law wanted to be there. And so we had to always, like, put the people on red alert that maybe it's today, and ended up not happening until finally, you know, in the middle of the night, probably around 3 in the morning, I was sleeping and I could feel these contractions starting to get strong. And I was like, oh, maybe it's now. And I remember walking into our living room and just kind of walking to see how these contractions, if they were real, if they were getting stronger. And they were getting pretty strong. Like, I had to kind of lean over something and breathe through it before it ended. And that's when I went to get my husband. I was like, okay, it's time. These contractions are getting pretty strong. Between contractions, I was fine. I was talking, smiling, but with a contraction, oh, I was not happy. So a neighbor actually came and got our kids, and my husband and I went to the hospital. And it was funny because they have a triage, and they took me up from the emergency room in a chair. And, you know, I was talking, smiling, and then I get a contraction, and then I wouldn't talk. And then I got to triage, and she's looking at me, and I already know what she's thinking. She's like, oh, she's not in labor, because that's what I would say as a labor and delivery nurse. You're too happy, you're smiling, this isn't quite labor yet. And I was like, nope, this is labor. Like, this is the real thing. So she was kind of being lackadaisy with me. She put me in a triage room, was kind of taking her time. And then she checked me, and she looks at me, she says, you're 6.5 centimeters. And I was like, I knew it. So they put me back in a room right away, and they put an IV in. And the doctor from the night shift was there. And I hadn't quite made a plan. I wasn't as well thought out as my second. I just wanted to have a baby. And she came in with the nurses and was like, okay, we're going to break your bag of water. And I'm like, why? And I said, I don't want my bag of water broken, because I knew it would make my contraction stronger. But she was like, what do you mean you don't want your bag of water broken? I'm like, I don't want anything done. I just want to labor. So she was kind of talking to her nurse, looking at them like, is this woman crazy? She doesn't want her bag of water broken. Like, she doesn't, she really wasn't going to ask me. She was just going to do it.
We can pause.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're already off, but it's fine.
But so she was kind of really surprised that I was declining her amniotomy to not let me, her break my bag of water. But I felt good to say no. I was like, oh, she can't come just break my bag of water because she feels like it.
Was she trying to speed it up?
I think this doctor was trying to speed it up, but I didn't know that. I just don't understand why she just came in and assumed she was going to break my bag of water. But after she left, I labored some more, and it was probably maybe 7 or 8, and they were getting pretty intense. And then I just was like, you know what? I don't want to feel this. I just want to have a baby. I want my epidural. So I asked for epidural. My husband's like, are you sure? I think you can do this. And I'm like, no, I just want to have my baby. It doesn't really matter to me. So the anesthesiologist came and he put an IV in my hand and it didn't work. So they put another one in. And I remember them like feeling pressure on my back as they put the needle in. And I got somewhat comfortable, but the epidural it didn't work that well. I could still feel lots of cramping down low. And then my mother-in-law finally came because she wanted to be there at the birth. It was probably around maybe 10 o'clock. And finally, I felt this really bad contraction again. And my husband's on my right side and my mother-in-law's on my left side. And they're holding my hand. And, like, I got tears in my eyes because it was so painful. And then I was like, I got to push now. And so they called the nurse in and I'm pushing without them asking me to push. And I push and the nurse is like, okay, stop pushing, because the head was just coming. So the doctor came in really quick and it was a different doctor. And she put her gloves on and I probably 2 pushes, my son was out. And he was small. He was like a 7-pounder. It's like I could have sneezed and he would have came out because he was a lot smaller than my other two. But it was really easy. He got on the breast and, you know, it was just a really quick and easy delivery. It was not at all like my other two. I think back and I'm like, man, I could have probably done it without an epidural. It probably would have been faster because it probably stopped my contractions or made them slower. So it was a really nice delivery though. It was fast. And within 2 days we went home and my boys are like 16 months apart. And it was like having twins. So everywhere I went, it was like somebody's, you know, strapped into the car seat. One wants to run away. Like that for me was like, okay, I'm done having kids. But I also really was interested in becoming a midwife at that point. And I knew if I had more kids, I wouldn't be able to do that. So I chose to have a tubal. And I didn't quite consult my husband. I just said, this is what I want to do. And he's like, are you sure? Isn't there something else? I'm like, nope, I don't want to have any more kids. And he was kind of bothered that I didn't make him part of the decision. But I was like, it's my body. I get to make that decision. But we, you know, my kids have, I was that mom for many years going to the grocery store where I had like a car seat and 2 toddlers in the stroller in the shopping cart trying to go grocery shopping. Like that was me. I mean, I would take them places to eat or by myself, and it was tough.
Is when you reflect back on those three births and your experience birthing, do you have any word or phrasing of words that kind of reflects that experience to you? I know they were very nuanced and different experiences, but you know, there's obviously things that are similar, you're giving birth, but is there anything that, like I said, a word or a phrasing of words that, you know, kind of summarizes that for you?
Summarizes?
The experience of giving birth to your children. It's a hard question, but we organize the stories and themes, and so it's a way of kind of like seeing if you already kind of have a theme in mind, you know?
No, I think I would say transformation for all of my kids. I definitely, hold on. Hey, Kansas, we're recording, so any little noise in the background, they're going to hear
really?
It. Yeah, can you?
We're almost done now.
Oh, okay.
And then you can come back in.
Okay.
think she's going to close the door. Maybe not. There he is. I would say transformation would be a big theme for my kids. Like I said, I came into motherhood not wanting to get married, right? I was going to be this career woman. And I'm married, and suddenly I'm having kids unplanned, but happy about it. And really coming into myself as a woman, as a mom, with becoming a mom with each of their pregnancies. Definitely being really challenged by family and perceptions about my role of being a woman and a mom. And challenged in a way that I've been forced to kind of hold my ground. You know, who am I? What am I about? And being okay with being myself, even if nobody agrees with me. I feel like the kids have really brought out that mama bear in me, you know, like I'm very protective of them. But over the years, like there've been little things that they've done that have just been, sorry. I guess the word is a blessing. I mean, it's really easy to get caught up when they're babies and feel some resentment that you're tired and you can't take a shower, or you're always responsible for them, or you can't go to the restaurant because they're crying or making too much noise, or they want to get down and play with stuff. But it's interesting as they get older, like you really get a sense of who they are. And they really enjoy spending time with you and want to do things together. It's almost like a role reversal. And they definitely keep me young. Like they all have their own little personality and pull me into things I maybe wouldn't do. But more or less make me more relaxed and not to take life so serious. Like my son will say, let's watch this show together. And he likes to really cuddle with me. And my other one, you know, Daniel is still very childlike and likes to go watch, you know, he's 12. So he'll go watch like kids cartoons still, and he's still into that. And my daughter, you know, she's 15. She likes to go to the spa, and we listen to the same music, and we share clothes. And I don't think anybody ever tells you that could be the future when you have these kids and you're giving up so much of yourself in the beginning. Like I think that's really unexpected. And, you know, in my 20s, I probably wouldn't be baking bread and making jam. And maybe I resented that because that was a female role I didn't quite identify with. And I don't know, now I really enjoy it and it feels good to be home. And, you know, there's so many more awful and challenging things in this world that to build this little cocoon of like home, like that's something that I'm responsible for. And some of the same things my mom did for me growing up, like cedaring off my kids with our feather and our sage to bless our home and to bless them. Like those are the things I do with them now. So they're going to associate those smells and acts with their childhood and hopefully carry it on with their kids. And so even though their childhood is going to be different and not playing in the river and doing all the things that I did, like, you know, I have the responsibility to show them things and experience things that I didn't, which is really nice. And, you know, my big goal with them is just to be loving, caring children and be respectful of people. My only hope is that they find a career or something that really inspires them and their passion. It didn't matter what it is. So it feels good to me whenever I go visit with their teachers that's what they say about my kids is they're really well behaved and they're kind and they're helpful. And that's the best I could ask. It's not so much about the grades or, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, what kind of people are they going to be?
perfect line, perfect ending line, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you have any questions, Ashley? We covered a lot of ground.
Yes. So good, first of all. And
so
I think
good. You're such a good speaker.
There's so many interesting facets of your story that I think it's going to make it slightly challenging.
Yeah.
But I'm... So this might be kind of delicate, and
okay.
It's okay if you don't want to talk about it, but one thing that you're talking about that I think is really fascinating, could be really helpful for other people, and something that we haven't heard at all, is this idea that you've been a victim of sexual assault, and mm-hmm. how that kind of trauma was revisited with pregnancy. I don't know if that's something that you're willing to talk about, your own experience
right.
of having to revisit that.
Right.
Just last night, actually, one of our speakers... She works with women of sexual assault and trafficking and everything. She works as a counselor.
Yeah, we actually need to connect you too.
Yeah.
Actually, we talked to her about you,
yeah.
and she definitely
you.
Wanted your
oh,
contact.
Yeah, for
yeah.
sure. Yeah, you could definitely connect us. You know, working through my sexual abuse, and I want to be clear, it's not just, I think sexual abuse is a very nice term. I mean, it was rape. I was raped as a five-year-old, as a teenager, I mean, early teen, and then as a teenager at a party. And definitely that has impacted me as a woman in my life, not just as a mother, but just my own self-worth. And definitely between the age of 20 and 30, as I was becoming a new mom, I was very much working through those issues of anger, frustration with my family and with myself and with my husband's family, and feeling worthy to be married to this wonderful man who, you know, really has stayed by my side through my own journey of finding who I am. I have to say, I haven't always been so kind to him because I've had my own issues that I've had to deal with. And even as my role is of being a mother, like I have to say, I really resented it in the beginning. I feel like I was meant to do something else. You know, I'm a mom. There's also some cultural connotations to being a mother. When I was growing up with my brother and sister, people thought they were my children, and because I grew up in a border town, people were like, oh, she's a teen, she's Native American, poor thing, she's having babies. She's not ever going to do anything with her life. So that was kind of that kind of pride that I was falling into this role of being your typical Dene woman who's not going to do anything and is going to have babies after babies after babies. And I definitely feel like women who didn't know me saw me with my kids and assumed either I wasn't married or my kids were not well-behaved. But there's these perceptions about who they are and who I was. And so part of going through that motherhood, knowing my history, was kind of grieving that childhood that I didn't have and that I had to grow up really fast. You know, I didn't have a 21 party. I had just had my baby. I had gotten married. Didn't have a bachelorette party when I got married. Like there's some milestones that I missed out on because I had kids early, and I resented that. There was also some family disputes happening between myself and my husband's sister that was really not positive for me. I was around a woman who was very negative and unkind to me, and feeling like I had to deal with that by myself while everyone kind of allowed it, kind of fit into this whole, like, I'm not worthy to be married to this really nice man. And that because I'm my mom, I'm supposed to not want things anymore. And that the career is that I maybe had thought I was going to move forward with is not attainable anymore because now I'm a mom. Like, this is all I should care about. This is all I'm ever going to be. And to me, that was really disappointing. Like, for me, I felt disappointed in myself. There's still pictures I look at from when my kids were babies that I look really checked out. Like, I'm not really focused and I'm not really talking. And I remember those times where I feel almost out of body, like, oh, I'm supposed to smile, so I'm going to smile now. Or, oh, I'm supposed to really enjoy this with my kids, so I'm going to act like I'm having a good time. Where my husband could see that's what was happening, and he would be like, you know, why are you not enjoying this? And I felt resentful, just like, why am I supposed, to enjoy this? This is work. This is really hard. You know, why am I supposed to smile through this? Feels like work. And so my kids really helped me want better for myself and to really fight for who I am and what I am and to fight for what I want. And midwifery school for me was part of that transformation because I had to fight for it. And once I saw the many options women had, it kind of made me reflect on what I had with my kids and what had happened to me. And so it was like I was able to feel like I had an identity outside of being a mom or this poor woman who had kids too early, right? So I don't know if that makes sense in regards to the abuse I experienced. It's interesting that I chose this hypnobirthing as one of my child preparation options because I've heard midwives say this all the time, like, well, the hypnobirthing allows moms to check out during their birth, during their labor. And I'm like, well, did it allow me to check out? Which you do when you've been raped. You check out. You go to another place while somebody's doing something awful to your body. Like, it's like, you can do this to my body, but you can't do this to my mind. I'm still who I am. Did I choose hypnobirthing because that's what it did for me? And I would say no. I felt every one of those contractions. I was fully committed and part of the decision-making about my body and my birth. And, you know, it's not true. I still felt everything. I just felt like I had more control. And I remember that because when I work with women who've been raped in their pregnancy, I know those feelings that they want control. They didn't have control when this thing happened to them. And that they want trust, and building trust with them is really important. And an example of that is I had a woman I worked with who had a really bad rape history. She came into my office just shaking, and she had sweat on her lip. And she first thing she said to me was, what are you going to do to me? And I was like, let's talk. So what I did is she sat in one chair and I sat one below her. So we weren't at eye level, it was below. And we start talking about what she was afraid of, what this was going to look like, how I was going to work with her, that we would do this together, and that I wasn't going to do anything she didn't want to do. She calmed down afterward, and we worked through her whole pregnancy. And the woman I saw at the beginning and the woman I saw at the end was completely different. Like, just very proud of herself. She felt very good about her experience. And, you know, I think about my experience in my births and my experience with my abuse. Like, I know how good it feels to have that courage and that strength to make those decisions and to feel like those are supported decisions. And that's what I try and work with women now as a midwife, because I know how important it is. And if without it, it's like, you know, I'm re-traumatizing them, and I don't ever want to do that. It's like, I don't want to be the rapist.
Yeah, I think that was a really good, wonderful perfect answer. Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we...
Mm-mm.
Yeah, you're incredible. You did a great job. I'm going to hit stop.